We're going to look at the book of Ruth. And for our study tonight, we're going to deal with the first five verses of the book of Ruth. And I want to talk to you about misery and Moab. Now, here in the book of Ruth, by way of introduction, let me just tell you a few things that we'll make note of. The book of Ruth, the overarching theme is redemption. It's the redemption of Naomi through Boaz and her daughter-in-law, Ruth, who had no children. And Boaz is the kinsman redeemer. The reason that's important is because that gives us the basis for Jesus Christ being our kinsman redeemer. Jesus Christ must have been a human in order to be related to us, in order to redeem us. Also, we have the life of David, or the lineage of David. As a matter of fact, this is where David comes from. And so, when we think about that, we also need to recognize that there is a Gentile woman saved here. That's of great importance, especially in the Old Testament. There were not many Gentiles. Outside of the great revival that Noah preached in Nineveh, Jonah preached in Nineveh, there were not many Gentiles saved. So here we have a Gentile saved, and we also have a great pattern for a virtuous woman. This Ruth was a model woman, and this is a good book for women to read and to read regularly, to look at the traits that she exhibited. So we're going to spend a little time in chapter 1. I must confess, all the commentaries I consulted on Ruth, when it came to chapter 1, they had very little say. There's kind of a hurry to get to Boaz, a hurry to get to the greater themes. And so I thought, well, we can't just skip over chapter 1. We wouldn't be doing the book justice. So we have to slow down and look at chapter 1. And I think there are some things in chapter 1 that we should understand. Now, even though the commentaries didn't say much about chapter 1, I've heard a lot of preaching from Ruth chapter 1. As a matter of fact, the preaching that I've heard has always been telling us how bad that Elimelech was for leaving Bethlehem. I've often heard it said that this is what happens when you leave God's place, you die. Judgment comes upon you. And Elimelech brought about judgment. And so I would hear preachers growing up, not just one or two, but I mean multiple sermons on Elimelech leaving Bethlehem and dying and his sons dying, as if God says, that'll teach you to go somewhere else. And I don't think that's justified. So I want to look at these first five verses, and I want to clear up some misconceptions about Naomi, Mahlon, Chilion, and Elimelech. So let's begin reading in verse 1. We'll read five verses. It says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. The name of his two sons was Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them. And the woman was left of her two sons and her husband." Now, there's five things that I want to pull out of these verses. There's five thoughts that I think we ought to consider before we get any closer or any further into the book of Ruth. The first thing that needs to be addressed is the political and physical conditions of Israel. The political and physical conditions of Israel. If you look there in verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled." Now, this means that everything happened in the book of Ruth took place during what we would call the time recorded in the book of Judges. Judges occurs from the time that Joshua passes away, and then the Lord raises up judges. These are individual men from different tribes and different backgrounds, and they are raised up by God to rescue Israel from oppression. So these judges, And the book of Judges run from the death of Joshua up to the appointment of Saul, the first king of Israel. You remember Israel started looking around and saying, give us a king like the other nations have. And you remember Samuel the prophet also operated as a judge. Remember he said, no, you don't want a king. And they said, oh, no, we want a king. And so they got what they wanted. They got Saul, and he was a sorry king. The period of time between Joshua and King Saul makes up what we would call the book of Judges. And that is roughly from about 1370 B.C., down to 1141, not B.C., A.D. So anyways, we're talking about from 1,370 years before Christ to 1,141 years before Christ. The story that we're dealing with probably took place somewhere under the Judge Jair of the book of Judges, chapter 10. And that would be somewhere around 1126 to 1105. B.C. Now, this is the time frame in which things took place. These judges ruled for about 270 years. But here's the interesting thing. The entire book of Ruth only covers about a 12-year span. And guess what? We're going to cover 10 of that 12 years tonight. So if you think I'm a slow preacher, I want to tell you something. We're going to cover 10 years of redemptive history in the next 45 minutes. So the entire story that we are reading only spans about 12 years. What do we know about the book of Judges? The book of Judges is a book of ups and downs. Israel would be on top of its game and have a great leader that would go out and conquer the enemy, and they would return morally to God, and they would begin to serve God, and then that man would die, and he would leave his sons in charge. And you know how rich, bold brats are when they take over? It never, seldom ever works out. And so they would fall into moral and spiritual decline. Therefore, God would raise up their neighbors to come in and plunder them and steal from them. And so you had this constant cycle of God raising up someone like Gideon or someone like Samson. He would raise up these judges, and they would bring victory and stability, and then it would go back in the toilet again. And so there was no political or military strength. They had weak leaders, and they had moral decline. That's the political condition of Israel in the time of Ruth, the time of this book. But let's talk about the physical condition of Israel. The text here says that while these judges ruled ruled Israel, there was a famine in the land. Now, there's no famine mentioned in the book of Judges at this time. So the famine doesn't correspond with any particular text, but likely it is the judgment of God. And the reason that we believe it's the judgment of God, the famine, is because when they left Israel, the Lord said, if you keep my statutes, I will send rain, early rain and latter rain. I'll send you the rain for your crops to sprout, and I'll send you enough rain to keep them growing, and then I'll stop the rain at harvest time. Because they looked at this promised land, and it was a land of mountains, an arid climate, and they said, we've been in Egypt watering our crops by foot. In other words, they've been digging trenches out of the Nile River and flooding their fields. He said, don't worry, if you do what I command of you, I'll water your crops. So if they didn't have water for their crops, that could only mean one thing, one of two things. Either number one, God failed on his promise to provide. No. Or they didn't do what they were told to do. How do we know that? Because the famines that were declared were always declared as a judgment upon Israel. Think back to our study of the prophet Elijah. For 3.5 years, there was no rain or no dew. And he's why? That they may know there is a God in Israel. So this famine was a judgment of God. And during this time of God's judgment, there was also a low view of God, and there was also a high threat of the enemy. This is the landscape in which Naomi and Elimelech are married and raising kids. These are desperate times. You know, I hear a lot of people talking about the condition of our country today and how bad it is. And let me tell you something, it's not great. And I'm not trying to play it down. But folks, We don't have the threat of an immediate invasion of the enemy on our borders. We do have food in our fridge, food in the stores, and food available to us. The time in which you and I live in is nowhere near as bad as the time in which this book is recorded, especially the beginning of our book. So this is a famine, and it's a desperate time. So when we look at this, the political and physical conditions of Israel are in the toilet, so to speak. They're as bad as they can be, okay? So that brings us to our next thing. Let's look at the personal and practical concerns of Elimelech. The personal and practical concerns of Elimelech. Look at the latter part of verse 1, and we'll look at all of verse 2. It says in the latter part of verse 1, "And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife, Naomi, and the name of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah, and they came into the country of Moab and continued there." Now the problem, the personal and practical concerns of Elimelech is chiefly this. This is a famine. This is a famine, and during a famine, there is no food. Here's what's interesting. The famine occurs in Bethlehem, Judah. Does anyone know what the name Bethlehem means? Anybody? Let me translate it for you. House of bread. There's a famine of bread in the house of bread. Bethlehem literally means the house of bread. The reason that it's called the house of bread is because this was an area that was great for growing wheat to make bread out of. This was a grain belt, okay? This was a place where wheat farmers lived. And in the house of bread, there is no bread. And not only is there no bread, but there's also political turmoil. There's no strong leaders. They're in trouble. Not only is there no bread and no strong leadership and a moral and spiritual decline, but notice what verse 2 said. He was married. He wasn't just caring for himself. I've often said if I didn't have a wife and two kids, I could live in a shack. You know what I mean? If it was just me, I'm telling you, I'd build a metal building with a garage door and an opener, and I would drive into my living room and park. I would have concrete floors. I mean, that's just the way I'd live. Don't have any worries. Don't have any cares. I'm low maintenance. But if I have a wife, all of a sudden I have a God-given responsibility to care for her and nurture her and protect her, provide for her. Add to my wife two children that I also have a God-given responsibility to be their father, protector, and provider. So during this famine in the place that's called the house of bread, there is a wife and two kids with Elimelech. He's got a very practical and a very personal problem. He's got to feed these folks. Now, I find the names of these four people very interesting. Elimelech's name means, "My God is king." My God is king. If you ever have time, this is just a sidebar, okay? A little side note. Get on YouTube and type in, "Do You Know My King?" by S.M. Lockridge. Watch that little 3-minute sermon. You'll love it. This guy's name is "My God is King." What kind of parents you think he had to give their child the name "My God is King"? Think he had good godly parents? Even in spite of the moral decay of Israel, I think he grew up in a home that believed in God. I think he grew up in a home that knew the Word of God. And so therefore, his name is "God is King." Naomi's name means pleasant. I'm going to tell you something. There's no finer wife than one that is pleasant to be around. A nagging wife is the worst thing in the world you could possibly come home to. But if you have a wife who is pleasant to be around, a joy to be around, well contented, happy when you get home. That's a blessing. Here's a man that grew up in a godly home, and you know what? He got a godly wife. You say, boy, what'd they name their kids? Funny that you should ask that. Milan means sickly. Sick. Anybody ever thought about naming their child sick? Chilean. Chilean. You ready? The younger brother of sick, his name means weak. Think these two boys ever got picked on walking home from school? Here comes sickly and weakling walking down the road. Their dad's name is God is King. Their mom's name is Pleasant. But their names are sick and weakling. Think about that. Think about this name of sick and weakling. So why would you name your kid that? Probably because they were sick and weak. Their first child probably had a lot of health problems from birth. Their second child must have had the same problems. So here's a man, a godly man, with a good woman, and he's got two sick kids, and he lives in a country that's under constant threat of the enemy, with a low view of God, with no great political leader, and on top of that, he happens to be living as a farmer or in a farming community called the House of Bread, and there's a famine. So not only does he have no food, but he probably has no work. What's he to do? What could he do? The Bible here says he's an Ephrathite. What exactly does that mean? That means he's from the city of Ephrath. The city of Ephrath is no longer called the city of Ephrath. Does anybody know what it's called today? It's called Bethlehem as well. It's also called the city of David. The city of David. But you see, Elimelech had no idea what the city of David would mean to us. When we say the city of David, you know what that means to us? That's the city that David came from. Who else came from that famous city, that old little town of Bethlehem? Have you ever heard a song about Bethlehem? Maybe in the wintertime when it gets cold, anybody? Anybody ever heard about the city of David? That's famous to us, isn't it? He really didn't have much fame during Elimelech's time. He had no idea what would become of that city. You know why? It was his wife and daughter-in-law that the Lord used to make Ephrath the city of David. So here he is with two sick kids, a farmer, and the Bible says he's going to sojourn. That means live temporarily in the city of, or in the nation of Moab. Moab is the enemy. Now here's what I said every preacher I ever heard preach on Elimelech said. Why in the world would any God-fearing Christian go live among pagans? As if you and I don't live among pagans. As if you and I don't work with pagans. As if you and I don't have neighbors that are pagans. Some preacher will stick his chest out. Bless God, I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of the wicked. Well, let me ask you a question. What if you didn't have a job, didn't have any food, you had two sick kids and a wife to take care of, and you had no way to feed them? What would you do? And then I can anticipate an answer. Well, I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive. I'll just go out and shoot deer and shoot squirrels and catch catfish. Okay, let's fast forward to the end of your scenario. There are no more deer. There are no more catfish. There are no more squirrels. Now what will you do? Because the famine that we're talking about doesn't give us any clue that he still had food in the cabinets and food to be gotten. What would you do? Would you sit there and just trust God to send ravens in to feed you like he did Elijah? No, my friend. If you heard that there were jobs and food to be had in the neighboring country, you would pack up your wagons and head to Beverly. Just the way Jed Clampett did when he got rich. You'd move out. You would go where the money was. You would go where you needed to go. And that's not wrong. Can I tell you something? We have a very famous godly man that did that. His name is Jacob. He happened to have 12 sons. They became the 12 tribes of Israel, and they sold their younger brother, Joseph, off into slavery. You remember? And God told him 7 years in advance, while he was a prisoner in Pharaoh's prison, that there would be a famine. And he told Pharaoh, and Pharaoh made him second in charge, only answering to Pharaoh. And what happens? There's a famine over there in Canaan. And Jacob and his 11 boys are starving to death. What does he do? He ends up in Egypt. You say, well, that's different. Because they hadn't received the promised land yet. They were just journeying in a strange land that they didn't own yet. God hadn't given the land until Moses. Okay, fast forward to the book of 2 Kings. There was a great prophet, perhaps you've heard of him. He had a double portion of Elijah's spirit. His name was Elisha. And he happened to know a widow woman. Happened to know a woman that didn't have any children. And she let him stay at her house and built him a little room. And so he prayed and God gave her a child. And that child died. You remember that? And they sent Gehazi down to lay the staff on it and he didn't come back to life. So Elisha went in the room and shut the door and stretched himself out upon the child. And the child came back to life. You remember that? You know what Elisha told her? He said, you need to leave here and go dwell in another country wherever you can find food because there's a famine coming. Now, if it's wrong for someone to leave Israel, why would God's man, warned of God, tell another godly person to get out of the country and go dwell in another land? And if God didn't want her leaving, why in the world, when she came back to talk to the king about getting her land back, was Gehazi standing there talking to the king and said, lo and behold, king, here's the woman whose son died that Elisha brought back to life. And here the king has an attentive ear. And he says, really, you're the one? Yeah, this is my son. Is there anything I can do for you? Yeah, there is. I've been gone and I want my land back. He didn't say, oh, no. If you leave Israel, you don't get your land back. No, he sent a sheriff out and said, restore this woman her land. Why did he do that? Because she did nothing wrong. Why in the world do you think Elimelech did anything wrong? He's got two sick kids and a wife and nothing to eat. Why do we keep calling him a bad man for leaving the country, for only doing what you and I would have done? Is there any indication that Elimelech is not a godly man? Is there anything in this text that would seem to point that Elimelech is not living up to his name, God is king? No, as a matter of fact, the text points to the fact that Elimelech is a godly man. And I think he's got a bad rap. So I'm going to determine not to ever preach bad about Elimelech. Because with two kids and a wife, no food, no work, we'd load up our family and go where it was. So, that's what happens. Up to verse 2. Let's look at the people and practices of the country of Moab. The people and practices of the country of Moab. Now, if he's going to Moab, you and I ought to know a little bit about Moab. Does anybody know how Moab began? You remember Sodom and Gomorrah? Who got out of Sodom and Gomorrah alive? Lot and his two daughters. You know what happened there? Lot would not let his daughters marry any of the men in the land because they were all evil. And they lived in a cave with their father Lot. And finally the two daughters developed a plan and said, we're going to grow old and have old maids and there's not going to be any children to carry on our lineage. So you know what their great plan was? To get their father drunk and sleep with him while he was drunk, in order for them to have children. So the oldest daughter got him drunk and slept with him the first night, and the second oldest, or the younger daughter, got him drunk and slept with him the second night. And the oldest daughter had her child first. And you know what his name happened to be? Moab. You say that Lot was a sorry guy. No, Lot was a righteous man, or he would have burned in Sodom and Gomorrah with the rest of the unrighteous. The Lord rescued righteous Lot. But the country of Moab was built on an incestuous relationship between a daughter and her dad. And the guy the country's named after, the head of the country, had a sister mother and a father. That's Moab. Why in the world would anyone go live in Moab? Wait a minute, Moab gets worse. When Moses is leading the children of Israel into across the wilderness, and in Numbers 22 through 25, they come to the area of Moab, and they want to travel across Moab to get into the promised land. And you know what? A very famous person in Moab comes out, the king of Moab. His name is Balak, and he has a prophet named Balaam. And Balaam tries to curse Israel according to Baal, and he couldn't do it. God wouldn't let him. He said, I've tried and tried and tried to curse them, and I can't curse them. So he said, I've got another plan. Here's what we need to do. We need to send our best-looking women out to marry those young Israelite guys, and then we'll marry them into our family, and we'll pollute them with our women. We'll pollute them with our gods. That was the tactic of Balak and Balaam in Numbers 22 and 25. And guess what? In Numbers 23, verse 3, the Lord barred them from entering the temple for 10 generations. Because of what Balak and Balaam did, God said, you cannot enter my tabernacle for 10 generations. What kind of gospel program did they have? They didn't have one for at least 11 generations. They were not allowed to worship the God of Israel for 10 generations. They were not allowed to participate in the worship that God commanded of himself. Don't worry. Ruth comes along about 11 generations later. Isn't that interesting how God does the math? Well, it gets worse. In the book of Judges, chapter 3, verses 12 through 30, Moab oppresses Israel for 18 years. So for 18 years, they raid Israel before Israel finally runs them out and gets their land back. This region happens to be east of the Dead Sea. Have any of you ever watched National Geographic or the History Channel and seen anything about the Dead Sea? You have any idea why they call it the Dead Sea? It's below sea level. There's no rivers or streams out of the Dead Sea. There's only rivers and streams into the Dead Sea. And the reason it's the Dead Sea is because the only way water gets out of the Dead Sea is by evaporation. And when water evaporates, salt stays. So the Dead Sea is like two or three times more salty than the ocean. And when you ever wade out into the Dead Sea, you can't go under. Because the salt is so dense in the water, you can just like stand upright and float, and your feet will float out from underneath you, and you can't hardly get your head underwater because it's so salty. And all the land around the Dead Sea is pretty much just like the Dead Sea. It's dead. The people and practices of Moab, they are not good. They are the enemies of God. This is not a place you want to go and raise dairy cattle. This is not a place you want to go and plant soybeans and watermelons. This is the kind of place that you need to have some kind of a trade to make a living. This is the kind of place you might want to own an inn and a swimming pool. There's not people going here to live in large numbers. It would have to be a severely bad famine for you to say, hey, let's take a chance at living in Moab. Especially if you're an Israelite and you've been at war with them in the last 100 years. Especially if there's still resentment over that war. Especially if they've been your arch enemy. Why in the world would anyone want to go live among their enemy in a dry, arid desert climate? It does nothing more than to prove the famine in Israel must have been severe for Elimelech to say, I'm going to go live among my enemies. These wicked people that God cursed for 10 generations. So in verse 3 and 4, the problems and panic are compounded on Naomi. The problems and panic are compounded on Naomi. Look at verse 3. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left and her two sons. Let's think about this for a moment. Elimelech dies. They're on their way to a better life and he dies. So it was bad enough, you remember, to have no job, to have no food, to have to take care of a wife and two children. Now we've taken the breadwinner out of the picture. Now we have a widow with two kids, and she's in a foreign land, the land of their longtime enemies. Can you imagine your spouse with your children in Afghanistan looking for work and a place to stay? Huh? This is horrible. This is not just a problem. This is a severe problem. What in the world will she do? How will she survive? How will she raise these two kids? Is she going to simply watch them starve to death in this dry, arid desert climate with nothing but a saltwater sieve to look at? How's she going to make it? She has a plan in verse 4. And they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelled there about 10 years. Now, this word "and," in some translations, is translated "then." And I think that's fitting. Then. When? After Elimelech died. Something tells me that Elimelech would not have let his children marry Moabitess women. Something tells me that the man whose name is God is King would not let his kids intermarry. As a matter of fact, the only thing I see done wrong in this whole text is the marrying of women outside of Israel. This should not have been done. And it doesn't occur until after Elimelech dies. But what would that do for Naomi and these two boys? Well, number one, when you married a woman, you usually got a dowry with her. You received some money. You received a little bit of inheritance. So when Milan and Chilion married these two women, they received some money. And guess what else? They had family in Moab. Can you imagine what the benefit would be of having family in Moab? They don't know anybody in Moab. They don't have any friends there. They don't have any place to stay there. Now, Naomi now has money to purchase food. Naomi now has friends in town. Naomi now has local support. She has the in-laws of her sons to call upon to receive help from. Now, she's finally stabilized herself. Now these boys are their own men. She can spend the rest of her days helping these two boys and their wives establish their families. Probably for the first time since the famine began, Naomi can say, "We will be fine." The only problem with that is they were fine. They were a little too fine. You know what? These women are really good women, and my boys really like it here, and they both found good jobs, and I've got a nice little apartment, and this is really better than we ever thought it would be. It turned out okay, and they stayed for 10 years. 10 years! Elimelech left Israel to sojourn in Moab. You know what sojourn means? Just hop around, be a day laborer. Wherever the peach harvest is, that's where he's working. Wherever they're building a highway bridge, that's where he's working. Wherever there's work, he's going to hop around, keep everybody fed until the famine ends in Israel. He's no longer going to set up shop. He's just going to hop around, sojourn, go wherever he can find money. Here's our problem. When these two boys got married, the sojourning ended and the settlement began. If this famine had really lasted in Israel for 10 years, don't you think somebody in the book of Judges would have made note of it? 10 years of no crops? Don't you think that'd be newsworthy? Not even, maybe it wasn't mentioned in the book of Judges, but don't you think other countries would say, "We're making a fortune for 10 years selling bread to Israel"? As a matter of fact, Egypt bought most of the world during a 7-year famine under Joshua's control. Everybody sold what they had. Even the free people of Egypt sold what they had. And Egypt became a superpower because of a 7-year famine when they had no food. What do you think would happen if Israel had a 10-year famine? I can assure you, folks, it'd show up in the headlines somewhere. It didn't. You know what that tells me? There was no 10-year famine. They left because of a famine. The spiritual leader died. The boys married local women, and everything worked out fine. There's no thoughts of returning. Things are looking up. I kind of like Moab. I've gotten used to the salt water. I like my little apartment. I never liked being a wheat farmer's wife. Naomi seems quite comfortable here. That brings us to our fifth and final thought. The providence and provision are controlled by God. Providence and provision are controlled by God. Have you ever heard the verse, "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away"? We're going to experience those right here in this verse. Verse 5, Mahlon and Chilion died. Also, both of them, and the woman left her two sons, and left of her two sons, and her husband. The providence and provision are controlled by God. I don't mean to imply that this was God's judgment upon Naomi. I don't mean to imply that this was God somehow judging Mahlon and Chilion. I'm not trying to say that God grabbed a lightning bolt and struck them dead. Does your Bible tell you how they died? They didn't get struck with a plague. They weren't eaten alive by rats. How in the world did they die? You want to speculate a little? Their names were sickly and weakling. If your name is sick, wouldn't be a shocker if your mother outlived you. That name, Chilion, is the same words used to describe people with tuberculosis. If this was the actual condition of these two boys, there's no reason to believe that they died of anything other than natural causes. This doesn't mean that God said, "Y'all stayed too long, boom, boom, they're both dead. That'll teach you. What do you think about that, Naomi?" That's not how our God works. The Bible says our God is love. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of shocked that two boys named Sickly and Weakling actually had a 10-year marriage. That's kind of shocking to me. You know, with the great hospitals they had back then, with penicillin that didn't come around for another 3,000 years. Folks, it seems to me that God has been really blessed to Naomi, Chilion, Mahlon, allowing them to marry and live 10 years and be sustained. But God is also in control. He that knows when the sparrow falls to the ground has the ability to keep or kill any person on the face of the earth. And the Lord has chosen to allow these two to die. And so they died. But here's what's interesting. Naomi didn't. You know what that means? God's not through with Naomi. You remember that song you sang as a kid in Sunday school? Took him just a week to make the sun and stars, Earth and Jupiter and Mars. Remember all that? Talked about all the things that God did, and then they would have this phrase at the end, "But he's still working on me." The fact that Naomi's still alive means that God's still working on her. The fact that Ruth and Orpah are still alive means God's still working on them. So God's not through with these three women. They're still here. They're still alive. Now, if you thought it was bad in Bethlehem when the famine occurred with two sick kids and a wife, what did you think when they went into Moab and the dad died? Now, what do you think now when both of the boys are dead? You think, "Oh my stars, now what's going to happen?" Notice this, Naomi has never been by herself in the entire story. Every time that Naomi is mentioned, there is still there with her family. If these two boys had died 10 years sooner, Naomi wouldn't have a soul in the world to care for her. But the fact that God allowed her to have two daughter-in-laws for 10 years and develop a relationship, and for those daughter-in-laws to learn to love their mother-in-law, means that Naomi now, even though she doesn't know it yet, Naomi now has a traveling companion and someone who can go back and redeem their family's land. Naomi's thoughts after this, and we'll look at them next week, it seems to be one of these. My life's over. These 10 years have been horrible. I think I'm just going to go back and die. That seems to be her thoughts. What bad has happened in the last 10 years? A famine and 3 deaths. You know what that means? Something bad's happened about every 3 years. Have you been to a funeral in the last 3 years? You know what? You'll probably go to another funeral in the next 3. I buried my grandfather in February. My grandmother's in the hospital right now in hospice care. They said she probably has a couple days left. Does that mean it's been a bad year? No. I've really had some good times this year. The Lord's really blessed me this year. You know what we tend to do as humans? We tend to connect dots. We don't look at anything in between the dots. Famine. Elimelech dies. Malion, Chilion dies. These last 10 years have been ruined. No, they haven't. You had a famine and the death of your husband. You've had 10 great and glorious years with your 2 children. And now they're gone. You can't connect dots 10 years apart and declare those 10 years a waste. Well, I mean, you can. You don't have a very good rationale if you do. Naomi's in a struggle. She's down. She's depressed. She doesn't know what she's going to do. But I want you to notice what this struggle produced. It produced Ruth. You know what Ruth produced? Obed. You know who Obed produced? Jesse. You know that Jesse is one of the names of Jesus? He is called the root of Jesse. Wouldn't it be great if your grandson's name was a name that was synonymous with the Savior of mankind? Huh? You probably have great thoughts and plans for your grandkids. I hope they grow up and get a good job and get a spouse. Do you fathom the thought that Naomi would say, I've got a grandson that they named Jesus after? You say, Brother Harold, she couldn't even fathom that. That never even entered the cobwebs of her mind. No, because when you're in a struggle, you don't understand what's happening yet, future. You know what that means? Because you can't see the future and you can't know the effects that you're having right now on the future, here's what you can know. If you are in a struggle, then guess what? God is working on you. God's working on you. He uses our struggles in order for us to develop a closer relationship with Him. When do you pray the most? When you have everything you want? Or when you're in a time of need? Anybody pray more when they have everything they need? Anybody? No. When are you closer to God? When you're on the mountaintop going, look, I'm here, I did it. Or when you're in the valley going, is there anyone out there? Naomi here is in a valley. Problem with her valley is she's trying to connect back to events 10 years previous and say, my life is over. And what God is trying to say is, Naomi, you don't have a clue what's fixing to happen in the future of your family. You don't realize what an upgrade you're about to receive. When you're in a struggle, you should wonder, what's God up to? Do you think that He just doesn't know what you're going through? Sometimes in anger, we've said that to God. Lord, you just don't know what I'm going through. Oh, yeah, He does. You remember He took on flesh and for 33 years walked the earth, suffering the reproach like no man before ever suffered, yet without sin. So when you're going through a struggle, do you say, God, do you know what I'm going through? Do you realize what I'm enduring? Do you see how bad the last 10 years of my life are? Or do you say, the Lord must still be working on me? When you go through a struggle, do you say, I wonder what God's up to? Now, here's what you ought to do right now while we're here and it's easy and we're talking about it. What's your current struggle? What are you struggling with right now? You struggling with your job? Struggling with your spouse? Struggling with your kids? Struggling with your grandkids? What's your struggle? Struggling with your neighbor? Struggling with your preacher? Hey, it's possible. I'll admit. You're struggling. What are you struggling with? Struggling with your parents, relationships, money, time? Before you sit down and start counting up all the problems you've had and talk about how bad everything is, here's what you should ask yourself. Lord, you have placed me in this struggle for a reason. Because through your providence and your provision, you've brought me to this point in my life, and you wouldn't have me enduring this if it were not for my betterment and your glory. You see, Naomi is not only going to return to Israel, but she's going to return to Israel and retire. Not return to Israel and die. She's going to return to Israel and be taken care of for her remaining days. She's going to return to Israel and not only herself benefit, but she's going to return to Israel and glorify God through the faithfulness of her and her daughter-in-law, so much so that her daughter-in-law's name, Ruth, is not only going to be have a book written with her name on it in the Old Testament, but her name is going to be mentioned in the New Testament. You say, where is it mentioned that in the New Testament? I'm glad you asked. Matthew chapter 3. They give the lineage of Jesus Christ. All men except for three women. Three. Tamar didn't really have an illustrious story. She was married to a man and didn't have any children. Man died. So the law says if you die without any children, your brother-in-law comes over and gives you children. Brother-in-law came over and he died, and her father-in-law said, I'm tired of losing boys to this wicked woman, and wouldn't give her any more children, any more boys to come over so that she could have a child. So you know what she did? Tamar took matters in her own hands and disguised herself as a prostitute and tricked her father-in-law into sleeping with her so that she could have children. You say, man, what a gutsy move. She's in the lineage of Jesus Christ. The next woman didn't act like a prostitute. The next woman was a prostitute. Her name was Rahab. She's famous for living on the wall of Jericho. What do we know about the walls of Jericho? They all fell down. Well, they didn't all fall down because where her house was on the walls of Jericho, it didn't fall down. And her family were the only survivors of the city of Jericho. And she was a prostitute. Yet she was married by an Israelite man and is included in the lineage of Jesus Christ. And then our third woman, Ruth. Here's what's interesting about Ruth. Ruth never done anything sneaky. Ruth never done anything wrong. Ruth never used deception. Ruth is the only woman mentioned on that list that lived a virtuous life. Ruth is the only woman on that list that never had a bad, rotten past other than simply being born a Moabite. You say, preacher, there's no possible way Naomi could fathom everything that's going to be recorded about her. You're exactly right. And can I tell you something? Whatever you're struggling with right now, there's no possible way that you can fathom the outcome of your struggles. So don't start connecting dots and talking about how bad your life is. Start trusting God and recognizing His providence and provision for you. Amen.